This is the 16th of August, 2008, for future reference. And I am miraculously sitting in Paris, talking to a friend of half a century, Frank Sherman. We are in Frank's Paris flat, would you believe it, looking out over greenery and sunshine. And I'm talking to Frank because he was paying attention to KPFA in Berkeley before I was paying attention to it. So what I'm going to start by doing is ask the question that I have asked every person that I have interviewed in the course of this, which is, how did you first hear about KPFA? How did you first become aware of it? What happened next?
I think some other student friends who well, because few of us had FM radio, so that it wasn't you know, it wasn't well known to a lot of people the way it would be later on. But yeah, I can almost remember somebody telling me about this station that played a lot of classical music and had all sorts of interesting interviews. I can remember one older lady student. Her name was Carol Vassallo, who told me about it. Now, I don't think she had an FM radio either. I mean, I think she had heard or was hearing it some other way, because that became one of the big problems of KPFA, was to get FM radios spread around and to make them affordable, so that the audience that it was, well, the natural audience for the station were, well, the natural audience was the student body, and they were, of course, were the ones that weren't flush with money and weren't ready to buy the average kind of FM radios. FM was still relatively new then.
Yes.
Well, we were talking before about how the GrandCo came along and to some extent helped to solve that problem.
Yeah, in fact, KPFA promoted FM as much as FM promoted KPFA,
Yeah,
as it were.
right. And it was quite a while after I knew about the station and knew of its existence before I actually heard it, and even longer before I finally got an FM. Trying to remember, I think I had a. I can't remember. I never had one of the GrandCos. I've had some kind of tuner, so that I was using it through another piece of equipment. But it would have been pretty simple to start off with. And of course, once I was able to listen to the station, I was absolutely hooked. I could remember when you said that I was paying attention. I could remember trying to convert you and Paul
I can
to,
remember it
yeah,
as
right,
well.
to, and well, eventually you became more than converted, but I was not successful at that in that early point. Even though both of you were absolute devotees. Well, of course, the thing that formed our bond was really our interest in classical music and collecting LP records and visiting Sea of Records. That was finding those wonderful old Friedrich Wurr, Schubert
Schubert,
recordings
yes,
on Vox. I can remember, yeah.
Well, of course, in those days, KPFA was involved with politics as much as with
yeah,
music.
oh yes, right,
That was the
right.
start. And In my own case, and I think in Paul's, we were at that stage not all that interested in political controversy.
Otherwise,
if anything, put us off of KPFA.
Otherwise engaged. Yeah. Well, one thing I would mention about how much KPFA had, I think perhaps, and I'm not really certain of this, that my first tuner might have come from Thos Tenney. And of course, Thos Tenney was a very good supporter of the station by providing them with LP records to play.
Yeah.
And I almost think he dealt in equipment as well as records.
Of course, one thing that worked to KPFA's advantage about FM as it came in was that the sound quality of music over FM was so much better every respect than over AM. So the music was one of the biggest pluses.
Being on FM at all. And the total absence of advertising. Mm-hmm. And the fact that they could play an opera, I mean, you would hear the whole opera. In fact, one of the programs that I remember hearing first on whatever equipment I got was Alan Rich playing a performance of La Boheme. No, Madame Butterfly. Yeah, mm-hmm. with Tibaldi and whoever else was on that early London recording. Mm-hmm. And I already knew who Alan Rich was. I mean, so there he was,
Now over time, you became personally acquainted with more than one of the people who were broadcasting at KPFA.
Yeah, well, when you had become attracted to the station, of course, you very soon realized that they were existing on a shoestring that was very likely at any moment to give out or break, or and there were always appeals for volunteers, and eventually there was a young guy whose name I don't remember now. He had married a German girl. He had been in the military in Germany. Not during the war, but right after the war, and he'd married a German girl, and he had some position at KPFA. He didn't broadcast, but I got to know him, and I think through him I got interested. Well, why shouldn't I be a volunteer? This would have been quite a while after I'd really listened to the station and enjoyed the commentators and the variety. I mean, there was every view from the most conservative to the most radical. I mean, and they had these guys that were, well, almost freakish. And by that time, I'd been listening to the station and really appreciated it, and had heard people like Lou Hill and Eleanor McKinney, and heard people talk about how the station came into being and the purpose of it and so on. I mean, realizing very much that if this thing was going on, volunteers were essential. So I never had a position at the station. Although on one of those little, were they weekly or monthly programs? I can't remember which.
I think they were bi-weekly.
Yeah. Okay, bi-weekly. I enjoyed the fact that once my name appeared on one of those. Unfortunately, I don't have a copy. I would really like. In fact, I don't have any of those. And I wish that I had hung on to, some of them, just as mementos of what that station was. Because, as I was saying, the thing that was so fascinating about it was the variety of opinion. And you know, some of these, well, I was mentioning this one quirky guy who was a someone named, is it Stephen George, who published a book. His theory was that all tax should be on the land. That was a single tax. This guy was extremely bright.
Not Henry George.
It is Henry George. Henry George. Yeah, and this commentator was a...
The single tax.
Yeah, right.
It was called generic.
He was an absolute disciple of, could meet all arguments that would be put up against him. I mean, he was really good, but there was such a variety of opinion. There was a lot more than political commentary too. There was a good deal of commentary on the arts. There were many literary programs. You know, discussions of literature, broadcasts of recorded drama. I think KPFA got some BBC.
Oh, they got a lot.
They subscribed to
the BBC transcription service, you paid more or less a blanket charge, and then you paid some in addition per program, that was back in the days when the BBC was actively, you know, promoting itself and promoting Britain. So to non-commercial stations, and there were such things around the world, although so much in America, the subscription charges were so minimal it was a very cheap way filling airtime.
Of getting very good programming. Of a quality that a small station like that couldn't think of creating. But they created some pretty good things anyway. I mean,
When you were there, were they already getting tapes from Broadcasting Foundation of America that included every year the complete ring cycle from Bayreuth?
I don't really remember whether they got festival tapes of that sort or not.
Because they did later on, and it became a sort of an annual feature. At one point in the year, the entire ring cycle would be broadcast straight through the day and take up.
That was definitely probably after my time at Berkeley, because I certainly, Barbara and I both...
It's something you would have remembered.
Definitely. Mm-hmm. Now,
you mentioned that you knew Alan Rich, and I think you said you had taken a course for him at one point.
By this time I had listened to him a great deal on KPFA, and of course, we were mentioning that I initially knew him from he worked for a time in art music, the record and music store
I worked as well, but not at the same time.
If you patronized that store at all, and I admit that probably what I did was went there and spent a lot of time listening to things that I couldn't afford to buy, but would have loved to buy and at least could hear, because they had decent listening.
They still sold 78s in those days.
I remember one piece in particular. I've forgotten exactly what it's called. It's in one of the Bach suites for unaccompanied violin, and as a preludium, I think it is, that Heifetz recorded, and it was on a single 12-inch 78 RPM record, and I can actually remember listening to that there, because one of the young ladies that worked there said, "Oh, what good taste, you know." I can remember, of course, ultimately the music library in Berkeley. It was when it was down in that little building.
The temporary building.
They had nice listening facilities. You didn't feel that you were, you know, kind of taking up space that, here you were, it was okay. I mean, this was part of the privilege of being a student.
Yeah.
And of course, they had a marvelous record collection. These were basically 78s, but I can't really remember just when LPs. Well, I can remember my first
LP came along about 19
early 50s, 50, 50, 50,
right around 1950.
Yeah, because they came out with a device that you could, if you had one of the standard phonographs. The tone arm and everything, and I had one. As they went, it was a fairly good one. They had an attachment that you could attach. I can't remember whether you could do it yourself or whether you had to have it done for you. But once you had done that, you could then Columbia put out. You remember those little LP players that were in a plastic? Mm-hmm. It was a plastic case. If you bought one of those, and of course this goes along with getting FM radios into people's hands.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you bought one of these, you got three or four, maybe five of those early LP. records that Columbia put out. They were in those blue and white paper jackets. Most of them had been dubbed from 78s that they had done, because I can even remember some of the. Anyway, all of this, of course, was feeding into interest in KPFA,
FM and LP were coming in at the same time, more or less, together.
They all were such a step up from in sound and in availability too. Mm-hmm. I mean. It wasn't long before LPs were, there was Creeds where you could buy, where reviewers flogged off their copies and you could buy them for, his standard price was about $2 an LP record that would cost five, six, seven if you bought them new.
Yeah, they were expensive back then, relative to the standard of living at the time.
I mean, but 78s were even more expensive. When you bought a 78, a set of a Beethoven symphony, you had to save up quite a long time.
The semester that I was a reader for Sears Jane, we were talking about, and it was at the same time I was working at Art Music Company, part time, when I got my check at the end for the semester that I spent as a reader. I spent the entire check at Art Music Company on the complete set of the Schnabel Beethoven Society 78s of the Beethoven sonatas.
Right.
This 12, 13 volumes.
Were these Had the price begin to come down? Because as LPs came in,
yes, yeah. And in fact, the reason I could afford even it that was because I've forgotten his name, the guy that ran Art Music. Let me have him at half price.
Yeah, well, you're an employee, and of course that would entitle you to some, but he
gave me a further.
Yeah, what very soon began to happen after the LP really caught on, and the record companies themselves realized that, well, they better switch over, and of course there was the great battle of the speeds that went on between.
Because the first re-releases of the those sonatas that came out on LP were not very well transferred, mm-hmm. and I remember at the time.
Was this on Angel's special something of the century? I mean, a special gray label.
I don't remember but I do remember that it was a rather thin.
This is on LP.
They transferred to LP.
This, yeah, right.
I was for some years, glad that I had the 78s because on good equipment, they just sounded better.
Yeah, that was
of course now they've done really first rate transfers to CD, and do you know the whole Beethoven Society set is available on Noxus on their cut price CDs, but not in America. For some reason or other, copyright, they're not allowed to sell them over there.
This is the Schnabel set.
The Schnabel set, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. There has been.
And in fact, I put, months ago, Alan Rich onto this fact because he had written to me that he wished he could get, the rest of the Noxus the Schnabels,
right. Okay.
But he couldn't over there.
Okay.
And I pointed him onto where he could order them from by mail in Britain and get them, which he said earned me his undying gratitude.
Oh, great. Now there is. I've got a complete CD set that I got through Berkshire Record Outlet. It's not the Noxus label.
Right. Yeah, it's come out on more than one.
Yeah,
it's one of those things that Noxus bought up along the way, with everything else.
Yeah, because
and I don't think they bought exclusive rights to it. I think they just bought the rights to put it out.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Berkshire, by the way, has been one of my best sources for. I mean, they just really consistently. Unfortunately for me, they've pretty much gone online now. They still do send out, but they used to send out these massive catalogs several times a year.
Getting back to KPFA, I was great. Do you remember hearing any of the piano recitals recorded especially for KPFA by the local pianists of great repute?
Abrams. Wasn't there someone named Abrams who played Schubert?
Bernard Abramovich.
It is Abramovich, yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, yeah.
Who was a great supporter of the station. He was a supporter in the sense that he recorded, innumerable recitals for Peanuts, for the musicians.
Of course, I remember very well Nathan Schwartz doing recital. That was later on. But Abramovich, I once, not too long ago, the whole set of his of his LP recordings of Schubert came up for sale on Ars Antiqua.
Oh, yes? Really?
Yeah, somebody beat me to it. I put in an order for it, and it was gone by that time.
Too bad. Another great pianist that recorded for KPFA was Egon Petri.
Yeah, I was just thinking. I know that name, and I do remember that. There was some connection. You knew him through his daughter?
I never actually knew him, okay, but after he died.
Oh, okay.
It was a niece of his that came over,
okay.
And through her I met Ulla Petri, the sister.
Egon actually performed on KPFA.
Yeah, he did.
Oh, great. Because he's one of the very respected old-time pianists the few people that are around that actually heard him perform, they're very happy that they had the good fortune.
Of course, when KPFA first started out, 1949, not that long after the war, the tape recorder was not in general use and circulation then, and in the very first instance, most of course the LP record didn't exist.
Yeah.
It meant that a big preponderance of the station's broadcasting had to be live. Disc transcription was an expensive and unsatisfactory.
Yeah. All the political commentaries initially I think were live. I'm sure later on that they. That they were taped, but yeah, I do remember that was one of the, some of the Stella Tuga, the kids program, because sometimes there was almost a back and forth response that indicated this live thing. The people now you mentioned.
So you as a listener would be. Would be aware of the fact that you were listening to live broadcasts.
Yeah. Oh, yes,
and
definitely.
Not canned stuff.
Right. Oh, I could. In fact, I remember one. It must have been a weekend day, when Alan Rich was apparently running the whole station. I mean, he was like. Well, they had continuity, so that he could put. But he's. He was talking, and all of a sudden, he said, "Oh, there goes the phone, or there goes the doorbell," or something like that. It was like, "What?" It's just so immediate, This isn't some kind of canned broadcast you're getting. I mean, this is one guy running the operation. The people I got to know, the person that I just had. The greatest admiration for Lou Hill. I mean, his voice alone it wooed you. I mean, it was so magical. I never saw him, but I must say, I'm sure that one of the things that really converted me to be an ardent supporter of the station was hearing him talk, because when he talked about the mission of the station and about the problems. You wanted to pour out everything you could, to make the thing go. He was, and we've talked about Eleanor McKinney. That was another voice. I mean, she just had a magical voice. And then Chuck Levy and Virginia Maynard, but especially Chuck Levy, because in many ways he became the voice of the station. I mean, I think he did most of the continuity that they. Probably had on tape, so that when he wasn't there, actually doing it, and he had the University Explorer program. Or
that's
something,
right,
yes. Something like that.
Yeah, he did that for the commercial network.
Okay, I couldn't
later. I don't, it's possible that he may have started doing it for
KPFA. Yeah, I can't remember, but I got to know him and got to know him well enough so I could sit down, and I remember seeing him on campus and at the coffee shop and sitting down and having it. And
I just, could still hear his voice in my head.
Oh, it was such a. I mean, that's the incredible thing. Those people way back then, that those voices, I mean, they were not only great promoters of radio as an idea and of listener-sponsored radio, they just had gorgeous voices. I mean, they could have been anywhere and you know, on commercial radio.
You mentioned
Eleanor McKinney having been, but I really didn't know much about this, and never I found out more about Lou Hill after his well, what seemed to me a pretty early and, you know, unexpected death.
Well, suicide.
Well, that's what a loss. I mean, whatever the cause was, and to me, I couldn't believe when I heard that it was suicide. I just couldn't believe that such an idealist could for some reason be driven to, you know, to do
do
that.
This as I've gone into a great deal, you know, elsewhere, but very briefly. He had terrible, terrible back troubles.
Yeah, I've learned that too.
And that he was on, I think, it was cortisone. Treatment, which gave him, you know, enormous relief. But what was not known at the time was that administered in large doses, it produced you know, profound depression. And paranoia.
Yeah.
He screwed up his brain. Nobody knew it.
If Chuck Levy became the voice of the station, Lou Hill was always the soul of the station. Mm-hmm. I mean, you felt that he was the thing that made the station be. It wouldn't have been.
But all of these people with commercial. Commercially, quote unquote, saleable voices who could have been working but the thing that set them apart from the usual run of radio announcers was that, along with this beauty of tone, was the projection of intelligence and concern. These were not. Always be sincere, whether you mean it or not. You would have bought a used car for any of them. And you wouldn't have been cheated.
No. I'm trying to think of a few other people that I got to know. Well, I remember Gert Tiarito. She was at the station. Someone that you knew too.
Her husband was the first music director.
Well, as we were talking about things that KPFA did, of course, mm-hmm. covering the hearings, the Un-American Activities Committee hearings. I mean, this was, did KPFA have a hand in making that tape? It was the McCarthy people themselves that made the tape, because they remember the famous tape. What was it called? The documentary of the thing. There would be something like, "Oh, look at that student resisting," you know, as he was being dragged down the stairs with his spine thumping on each step. I mean, it was so ridiculous that it backfired. I mean, if they had attended anyway.
Well, they redid and reprocessed tapes that had been made by. The principal coverage, documentary coverage, was in fact KPFA reporters
yes,
that were over
right.
there.
Oh yes, right, right.
And Bert White and Fred Haynes.
Right.
I'm
trying to remember some of those other names of some of the other commentators.
Of course, one of the ironic things is that the KPFA got. Somehow, permission to record the proceedings inside inside the hall where they were going on,
yeah.
and partway through the committee realized that they hadn't made any provision for recording for themselves.
Yeah.
So at the end, they subpoenaed copies of the KPFA tapes. Now that did not mean that they took them away from them, it was a friendly subpoena in the sense please, can we have a copy and we'll pay you for it.
Yeah, right.
That's how they got their record.
Uh-huh. That alone. I mean, that was. Mm-hmm. Everybody found out and knew a lot about that whole committee and all the hearings that otherwise, I mean, no commercial station.
Elsa Knight Thompson produced a documentary program on the proceedings, which, as Alan Rich said later, he said the. Said those goddamn tapes were everywhere. we played them over and over and over again until the whole Bay Area memorized them.
right. But that was a very good thing. I mean, because
terrific.
There was just no other.
It was the training of a whole generation.
This was where I learned about the I.F. Stone Weekly, because they used to read.
They used to read
the I.F. Stone or read part of it, over the radio.
And later on we had I.F. Stone himself.
And this was a time when I.F. Stone was known to practically. I mean, just a teeny audience.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, his weekly. I mean, of course, Berkeley was one place where finally there was one bookstore. And not Berkeley Book, but
Moe's, perhaps.
Which
Moe's bookstore?
No. This was before the days of Moe. I think.
Moe
didn't
exist.
There were
such things.
It was another bookstore that had a very good department of. But anyway, they used to have the I.F. Stone Weekly on sale.
Uh-huh.
Well, of course, to start off with. The I.F. Stone Weekly was short enough so you could stand there and read the whole thing.
Yeah,
But pretty quickly you became a disciple, and I'm going to support this thing. And I mean, especially when you found out that this was some kind of practically a basement operation with one guy doing the whole thing, setting the type but it was through KPFA that I first learned of the I.F. Stone Weekly, and it was where does it come from, you know? I just really remember there were hundreds of other young people, especially students particularly, that found out about these things.
Do you remember hearing any radio drama on KPFA.
Yes, yes.
Aside from BBC.
Tom Sawyer ones that they did. Oh yeah, those were wonderful. I mean, that was among the very first times that I'd ever heard any dramatization, and these two wonderful voices. And I was so dismayed later when I had gotten to know Chuck Levy, and I asked him about those tapes. He said, "You know, we were so short of tapes sometimes that we had to reuse those tapes, and they don't. They don't exist anymore.
So much of it got wiped out.
Yeah, what a God. Something that I remember too, Henry Jacobs." You remember?
Yeah, that was music. I have an hour long interview with Henry Jacobs on the website. The same slot that you're going into.
Okay. Was it Music Concrete?
Yes. Well, he did sort of. You know, electroacoustic music experiments. He was experimenting with tape loops back in the recorded sounds, you know, put onto loops and played around and around back in the early 1950s. At the same time that Schaefer and Henri in Paris were doing Musique Concrète, and he was doing it independently. It wasn't as a result of his having heard what they were doing. And this 1953, 54, he was doing this, and some of the results ultimately went onto a Folkways LP of avant-garde music.
Did you live performances, not just recorded?
Yes, there was a lot of folk music. Partly because there was so much folk music of a political nature.
Was it on KPFA that the guy who did the equivalent of Golden Voices, Anthony Boucher?
Anthony Boucher.
This is really the beginning of mine and Barbara's interest and knowledge.
I have one of his programs on the website.
You actually gave me one on tape. And I finally sent it to the guy that does From the Recording Horn on a Chicago station because he knew of Anthony Boucher. And
it wasn't by any chance that very amusing one that they did called Vocal Villains.
That was it. Yeah,
that was the only one that I had.
Yeah, that was the one.
And that's up on my website.
His programs, we still have the tagline. Well, now, what would you like to hear next week? You know, write to Anthony Boucher, care of, blah, blah, blah.
Now I'd like to know what other voices from the past you'd like to hear.
That's right. He had a standard final finale to the program.
The tag.
He was the first, I can remember Conchita Supervia. Our knowledge that she existed, and it was really, my God, I mean, because now this is like one of my main interests, you know, and a huge part of my collection, you know, has grown out of this little seed, you know, that was planted, and that's the real value of that station, because who knows what, you know, what things have developed from people that got a start.
Elsewhere on this very website, I have Lawrence Ferlinghetti saying that Although, you know, he got a proper degree from the Sorbonne and all
yeah,
the rest
yeah,
of it, but
yeah,
he
yeah.
got his real education
yeah.
from KPFA.
Yeah, it was like, remember Melville said that the, I think the, whatever ship it was that was on, he said it was my Harvard and Yale College. It was wonderful, although we were going to a great university that was, provided us wonderful things, but there was something that KPFA provided that even the university wasn't presented in a different way. I mean, it planted seeds in a lot of people. I mean, there's a lot of idealism out there that can be traced back to, I think it's probably the only thing in my entire life where I was really strongly thought, you know, I could get involved in this and just devote myself to it rather than, yeah, and I mean, well,
yeah.
It's one of the most beautiful lines in a Brecht play is when he says, it's in the good person of such, I think it's in the good person of such a one. He says, she faced the awful temptation of doing good. I mean, it was. I mean, in context, it's such a moving. Oh, it just pulls your emotion out because it's such so appropriate. And KPFA was the kind of thing that you could have the awful temptation to do good, to yield to. To really put yourself into it,
the way that I summed it up in the one paper that I wrote about it was that so many wonderful things came out of it, not necessarily because the program participants and program makers were uniquely talented, but because it was a rare place where one could afford the luxury of habitual integrity.
Yeah, that's very well put. Yeah,
and
right,
there
right.
was
right.
you could get
true.
Into the
yeah,
habit
yeah.
of being
yeah.
honest.
Yeah, right. And you could think, my God, what if we could make the world this way? What if we could spread this out? You know, and well, of course, that's really the heart of the thing. It's just here's something that you know that's doing me a real good, and you know that it's doing this for a lot of other people as well, and you're really drawn into it. A little bit later when we had gone on, you caught the same thing caught you, and your association with the station was, and of course you got far more involved with the station itself. The volunteer work I did was mainly, I just at one point I would go around to where various students lived, you know, and knock on their doors, and tell them, and this was. I was not an official representative at all, but just try to get them to subscribe to KPFA. And after I was working with this guy whose last name Bob, whoever he was. I mean, he had kind of authorized me to do this, so I wasn't just doing it totally on my own. But ultimately, he said, "Well, you know, we've got these files of people." Of course, this was Gert Chiarito's special, but with her blessing or approval or something, I was able to go through the files, and people whose subscriptions had lapsed or something like that, I could, the phone numbers were there, and so I did phone, and that. But, you know, I did get a...
You were the Seventh-day Adventist knocking on the door.
Yeah. And of course, quite often the people knew, and often it would. I mean, they would, you know, come on in, let's have a chat, you know, or maybe have a cup of coffee or something. And I can remember one or two instances of really. having a very, I mean, it being not just at all an impersonal sort of thing, but that's but actually this person that I was telling you about on the listener sponsored station now in Chicago that I like so much, Jerome McDonald.
Yes,
he has an hour program every weekday, and one day a week, and he's been doing this. He started it up about 3 or 4 years ago. He said, "I'm going to try to find people that are trying to make the world a better place. Uh-huh. That have found some project that they can work yeah. on." And this is just snowballed. I mean, we've even had some people repeating. I mean, all kinds of people these are the kind of people that, you know, might well he's the kind, he's a KPFA person. Mm-hmm.